The dangerous chemicals in plastic include phthalates, which are linked to cancer and help make plastic soft, and bisphenols, which make plastic hard and are linked to reproductive health issues. Plastics have been found everywhere, from the deepest parts of the ocean to the tops of the Rocky Mountains and Pyrenees Mountains. They have also been found inside animals all across the food chain, from microorganisms to whales, turtles, and fish of all kinds. Because of their ubiquity, studies have found that the average American consumes a credit card worth of plastic each week. Plastic pollution is also at least partially responsible for the precipitous drop in human sperm counts that started in the 1970s and could lead to an infertility crisis later this century.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, as you know, we have been discussing about Mahdawiyat, Imam Mahdi, in this session. And today in our studio, we have with us Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Karimi.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
It's a pleasure to be with you, sir. Thank you for accepting the invitation.
Thank you for having me.
Let me give you just, we had been talking about the hadith of Saqalain, which says, in which Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, said, I am leaving among you two precious things which will not get separated from each other until they join me back at the pond of Kausar in heavens. So Dr. Karimi, we said that this hadith is quoted even in Sunni narrations, you know, Sunni authentic books, and many Sunni authentic rajals have mentioned this hadith. How does this hadith prove the existence of Imam Mahdi?
Again, the interesting point is that both Shia and Sunni scholars, they have argued with this hadith to prove the existence of a person from the Ahlul Bayt or the Itra. As you rightly mentioned, the Holy Prophet says, I'm living among you, the Muslims, the Quran, and my Itra, my progeny, and they are together till the Day of Judgment. Now, first of all, let me refer to some of the arguments mentioned by some Shia scholars. For example, one of the contemporary Shia scholars, Ayatollah Wahid Khorasani, may Allah protect him, he says that one of the reasons which proved the existence of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is hadith of Thaqalain. Why? Because according to this narration, the Holy Prophet says that the Noble Book of Quran and the progeny of the Ahlul Bayt, they are together till the Day of Judgment. So in each time and era, there must be a member of the progeny of the Prophet so that there is no separation between the Quran and that person from the Ahlul Bayt. And this is how it proves the existence of a person from the Ahlul Bayt.
Yeah, so you mean say like if Quran is in the society, so shall be the progeny.
Exactly.
So shall be someone from the progeny, Prophet Muhammad. Yeah.
Now, let me just refer to one point here. One may say that, okay, maybe the Holy Prophet meant, for example, the Quran and the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt,
yeah,
not a member,
yeah,
a living member of the Ahlul Bayt. So, for example, the Holy Prophet meant the Noble Book of Quran and the narrations of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So it doesn't prove the existence of other Imams.
Yeah.
Now, the answer to that is that if it was the case, then even we didn't need the progeny at all, because in that case, the narrations of the Prophet were enough for us.
Yeah.
So when the Holy Prophet is referring to the fact that in each time and era, people need two things, the Quran and the progeny, it means that it is important for that member of the Ahlul Bayt to be living among the people. So the narrations of the previous Imam or the Prophet is not enough, because in each time and era, people are in need of the answers to the newly raised questions. Okay. So we cannot claim that it is referring to the narrations. In that case, the narrations of the Prophet were enough.
Yeah.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. This thousand-year-old
The other argument in this regard is mentioned by one of the great Shia scholars who recently passed away, Ayatollah Safi Golpaygani. May Allah's mercy be upon him. He says that we can take 6 points from Hadith of Thaqalayn. First of all, the fact that it is an obligation upon all Muslims to refer to the Quran and the progeny.
Mm-hmm.
Second, the only way of salvation and being away from misguidance is to resort to the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, because the Holy Prophet says, as long as you hold fast to them, that is the Quran and the progeny, you will never go astray. The third point is that the condition for salvation is to referring to both of them, Quran and the progeny, not only one of them. The fourth point, which is also very important, is the infallibility of the Ahlul Bayt. I need to clarify this point because it's important too. How does the Hadith of Thaqalayn prove the infallibility of the Ahlul Bayt? Because this is one of the beliefs of the Shia, and the other Muslims do not believe in that. Although many of them, they highly regard the Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam, but they do not believe in the infallibility or isma of the Ahlul Bayt. Now, we can argue that, first of all, when the Holy Prophet says that if you refer to the Ahlul Bayt, then you will not go astray. This is proving the infallibility of the Ahlul Bayt, because if they are fallible like us, it means that they may lead us astray. They may commit sins or make mistakes when it comes to the religion. So when the Holy Prophet is giving us a guarantee like, as long as you refer to the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt, you are immune from any kind of misguidance.
Yeah.
It means that then it requires that the Ahlul Bayt must be free from any kind of mistake and even committing sins. And the second point which proves this fact is that the Ahlul Bayt are somehow, I mean, made similar to the Noble Book of Quran. And you know that the Quran is free from any kind of mistake. So the same should be true about the Ahlul Bayt.
Yeah, so, the one who explains
it. Exactly. So when, through referring to the Quran, we are immune from any way to misguidance. The same is true about the Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam.
Yeah.
The next point that Ayatollah Safi believes that we can benefit and take from Hadith of Thaqalayn is that the progeny of the Ahlul Bayt are the most knowledgeable people after the Prophet. Otherwise, the Holy Prophet should have introduced other people. And the last point is that in each time and era, there must be a living hujjah or proof from the Ahlul Bayt among the people. Why? He says that there are a couple of phrases in Hadith of Thaqalayn which proves the fact that in each time and era, we need a member of the Ahlul Bayt. Like, in our time, we need to have a living imam.
Member.
For sure, we believe that that is Imam Mahdi, son of Imam Askari, alayhi salam. And we know that the Hadith of Thaqalayn has been mentioned with different versions, I mean different phrases, like إني تاركم فيكم الثقلين or إني مخلف فيكم or I'm leaving among you two precious things. إني تاركم فيكم خليفتين. I'm leaving among you two caliphs. Or إني قد تركت فيكم or إني قد خلفت فيكم الثقلين. All these phrases means that after the Holy Prophet, the successor of the Prophet in all the issues are the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam.
Yeah.
Now, if there is no living member of the Ahlul Bayt, it means that in sometimes we have some gap, and in that gap, there is no successor of the Prophet.
Oh.
So when the Holy Prophet is telling us that I'm leaving two precious things, it means
things.
That in each time and era, we have the Quran and we have a member of the Ahlul Bayt. Then the Holy Prophet is talking about Khalifa, successor, it means for all the issues. And
yeah.
it requires for us to have a living member of the Ahlul Bayt in each time and era. The second point is that the Holy Prophet said, لَن تَضَلُّ مَا إِن تَمَسَكْتُمْ بِهِمَا لَن تَضَلُّ أَبَدًا. As long as you hold fast to the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt, you will never, never go astray. Lan in Arabic language refers to the fact that
never.
It will never happen.
Yeah.
So if we do not have a living member of the Ahlul Bayt, we cannot claim that for sure there is no misguidance.
We need someone to have, like, tell us answers, what will happen if this thing happens.
Exactly.
And as things change, time change, people change, so new things come up.
And the third phrase which proves the existence of a living member is لَنْ يَفْتَرَقَ. These two will never get separated till the day of judgment. So again, imagine if there is no living member of the Ahlul Bayt, like in our time, it means that there is a separation. Quran is there, but there is no member of the Ahlul Bayt to be together with the Quran. The Holy Prophet continues to say that حَتَّى يَرَدَ عَلَيَّ الْحَوْلِ till the day of judgment. Again, it refers to the fact that till the day of judgment, always we have the Quran free from any kind of distortion. And this is also one of the narrations referring to the fact that Quran is free from any kind of tahrif or alteration and distortion. And also referring to the fact that in each time, Quran and the progeny of the Ahlul Bayt are together. So
yeah.
This is the argument as mentioned by Ayatollah Safi Rahmatullah Alayh.
I'll be talking to you, Dr. Karimi. Here we need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is The Lost Savior. We have been discussing about the Hadith of Saqalain and how does Hadith of Saqalain prove the existence of Imam Mahdi. Dr. Karimi, you came up with a number of narrations. You came up with some of the points that were pointed out by great scholars. So do we have Sunni scholars saying something about that?
Sure. It is very interesting to find that the same argument among Sunni scholars, because we know that when it comes to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, the main difference is that they believe in Imam Mahdi, but they believe that he will be born in future. Interestingly, we find among some Sunni scholars the fact that they have also mentioned that Hadith of Taqalain refers to the fact that in each time and era, we need a member of the Ahlul Bayt living among the people, so that people, by referring to the Quran and the progeny, and I mean that member, they will be immune from any kind of misguidance. For example, Manawi, one of the great Sunni scholars in the 11th century after Hijra, in his famous book Faidul Qadir, volume 3, page 15, he says the following. He mentions Hadith of Taqalain, and then he says that we conclude from Hadith of Taqalain that in each time there must be a member of the Ahlul Bayt, and he should be there fi kulli zaman, in each time and era, ila qiyam as-sa'ah, till the day of judgment. Otherwise, we are not able to act upon this narration.
Yeah.
When the Holy Prophet is telling us that you need to refer to the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt, it means that in each time there should be a member of the Ahlul Bayt. Otherwise, he continues to say that they are amanun li ahl al-ard. They are a kind of safety for the people of the earth. فَإِذَا ذَهَبُوا ذَهَبَ أَهْلُ الْأَرْضِ. This is mentioned in many narrations that if there is no member of the Ahlul Bayt, if there is no hujjah, divine proof on the earth, then the whole earth would be destroyed. The other Sunni scholar in this regard is Ibn al-Hajar Haythami, who is also a very famous Sunni scholar. He says the following. The conclusion regarding Hadith of Thaqalain is that we need to refer to the Book of Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet and those people who are knowledgeable regarding the Quran and Sunnah. Who are they? He says Ahlul Bayt. We conclude from these narrations that these three, that is the Quran, the tradition of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, they are there till the Day of Judgment. This is in the famous book As-Sawa'iq al-Muhriqa, Volume 2, page 439.
Yeah.
Again, he says that the narrations which tell us to refer to the Ahlul Bayt, they refer to the fact that in each time and era on the earth, there is someone from the Ahlul Bayt, like the Quran. As we have the Quran in each time and era within our access, so we need to have a member of the Ahlul Bayt among us as well. Also, he refers to another narration which says that في كل خلف من عمتي عدول من أهل بيتي. In all the generations after me, that is the Prophet, there is a just person from my progeny. This is in As-Sawa'iq al-Muhriqa, Volume 2, page 442. Interesting point is that although they may not believe in Imam Mahdi alayhi salam as the son of Imam Askari alayhi salam to be the promised Mahdi, but they, at least some of them, they believe that in each time and era we need a member of the Ahlul Bayt living among the people.
Wow, that's so interesting. You came up with narrations from Sunni school of thought and as well as Shia school of thought that both say Prophet mentioned in the Hadith of Saqalain what are the Ahlul Bayt, and you said many famous known Sunni scholars say that we need the progeny of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his family, in all the times. Thanks. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, being with us. Thank you so much, listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Violent clashes between Sri Lankan police and anti-government protesters across the country have become commonplace in recent days. The protesters are angry at the government's handling of the country's worst economic crisis since its 1948 independence from the United Kingdom. The economic downturn has led to long lines for fuel, a short supply of essential goods, and seven-hour-long power cuts every day. The protesters are calling on President Gotabaya Rajapaksa to resign. The president, however, remains defiant. He declared a state of emergency on Friday and announced a curfew to quell the protests. However, the demonstrations show no sign of dying down anytime soon. The government blames the COVID-19 pandemic for the devaluation of the national currency and other economic woes, It says the outbreak has slashed revenues from tourism and the inward flow of foreign exchanges. But that's not the whole picture, at least according to economic experts.
The situation has been exacerbated in Sri Lanka due to the mismanagement, the political crisis, the corruption. The president and the prime minister are brothers. One of the nephews is a minister in the government. So it's, you know, it's extraordinary sort of nepotism which is happening in Sri Lanka. So that's one of the contributory factors.
A government expenditure that exceeds its income, ill-timed tax cuts, and a sudden shift toward organic farming that hamstrung the food industry in the country are also cited as reasons why the Sri Lankan economy is now in the doldrums. Sri Lanka is facing imminent default with over $7 billion of debt due this year, $1 billion of which are international bonds that will mature in July. This is while the country's usable currency reserves are estimated to have fallen to as low as $500 million. To stave off defaulting on its debt, Colombo has turned to regional superpowers, India and China, for bailout loans, securing a $1 billion credit line from the New Delhi late last month. But that's far from enough, which leaves Sri Lanka with not many more alternatives than the International Monetary Fund. But securing a loan from the IMF will come at a cost too, as the international lender would require Sri Lanka to implement fundamental changes to its fiscal and economic policies, something that experts believe would put much more pressure on the poor. Besides, as some commentators suggest, the demanded restructuring could infringe on Colombo's sovereignty.
As soon as IMF loans money to any nation, they want austerity measures. What that means in simple language is they want subsidies to be taken away from basic things that ordinary people use. Because what you've got to remember that in a developing country like Sri Lanka, the main budget of the ordinary masses is on food and accommodation and energy. They don't have any sort of residual income to buy luxuries. And if inflation goes up by 40% in these sectors, then it has a huge impact on the ordinary people.
No matter what route the country will choose, one thing is for certain. As long as the current economic climate stands, the developing nations would suffer under skyrocketing consumer prices, fuel shortages, and power cuts, which means more protests and political uncertainty in the indebted nations.
The holy month of Ramadan has begun for Muslims around the world. However, some struggle to observe it under inhumane conditions. Palestinians are facing a new round of escalations while being subjected to a blockade. The number of Palestinians killed so far this week has reached 10. The Gaza Strip-based Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, and the West Bank-headquartered Palestinian Authority have slammed the Israeli regime over its earlier targeted killing of Palestinian youths. In a statement, Palestinian presidential spokesman Nabil Abu Radeina said the ongoing escalation would blow up the situation in Palestine and the entire region. This came after Israel's occupation forces shot dead three Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin on Saturday, amid the escalation of Israeli violence in the Palestinian territories. Israeli forces assassinated the trio by opening fire on their vehicle near the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank. They later seized the vehicle and the bodies of the three people. Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of Islamic Jihad, identified the victims as its members. Palestinian resistance groups, Islamic Jihad and Hamas have vowed that such atrocious acts will not go unpunished.
If the Israelis see Ramadan as an opportunity when Palestinians, especially Palestinians who are associated with the resistance groups, if they see this as an opportunity for them to be gathered with their families, then they become targets. and their families become targets. So this is unfortunately something for the Israelis. This may be considered an opportunity to be more repressive than usual.
Palestinians were brutally attacked by Israeli regime forces at the Damascus Gate of the occupied Al-Quds on the second night of the holy month of Ramadan as well. It is customary for Israeli forces to exhibit increased levels of violence against Palestinians gathering in the area during the fasting month of Ramadan. At least 20 Palestinians were injured in the clashes and 10 were detained. Israeli forces have recently intensified their violent raids on Palestinian cities and villages. A fresh escalation erupted after Palestinian gunmen, angry over the regime's crimes and occupation, killed 11 Israelis in separate attacks. That's the sharpest spike in attacks on city streets in years. On Tuesday, a Palestinian shot dead 5 people in a suburb of Tel Aviv before he was killed by Israeli forces. The operation came days after 2 Palestinian gunmen killed 2 Israeli forces and wounded 4 others in a shooting attack in the northern Israeli city of Hadera before being shot dead. The latest round of escalations could lead to igniting another war between Israel and Palestine. Last year, protests against the illegal eviction of Palestinians from the homes in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah during Ramadan ignited an 11-day Israeli offensive on Gaza in May. At least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment. On the Israeli side, 12 people, including 2 children, were killed.
What's needed in order to do real resistance there is to make Israel extremely uncomfortable, and to the extent that they have to change their policies, or basically just hopefully it'll be so uncomfortable that they'll have to leave, which is of course what happened in Zimbabwe, the former Rhodesia, and in Algeria. The occupier left, and this needs to be the goal for Palestinians in order to the goal of their resistance.
The Israeli regime has for years guaranteed its security by attacking Palestinians, but now things have changed and Palestinian people and resistance groups are ready to retaliate. A Turkish prosecutor has requested to halt the trial for Jamal Khashoggi's murder in Istanbul and transfer it to Saudi Arabia, some 4 years after the dissident Saudi journalist was murdered in Turkey. The court requested the Justice Ministry's opinion on the issue and is expected to rule on the request at its next hearing, set for April 7th. The Saudi Chief Public Prosecutor's Office had requested the transfer, and evidently the Turkish courts are planning to comply. Turkey's justice minister said earlier that his ministry would approve a request to transfer a trial over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi to Saudi Arabia. Human rights groups have condemned the move, saying Riyadh cannot be expected to hold a fair trial for the alleged killers of the journalist. In 2020, Saudi Arabia jailed 8 people for between 7 and 20 years for Khashoggi's murder. None of the defendants was named in what rights groups described as a sham trial. Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. A U.S. intelligence report released a year ago said Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had approved the operation to kill Khashoggi. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said the murder had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government, an accusation that has already strained the relations between the two countries and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish goods, which cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. The request by the Turkish prosecutor comes as Turkey seeks to mend ties with Saudi Arabia.
the Saudis absolutely have both an economic and a political interest in further ties to Turkey and Erdogan. I think it is a relationship where both of them are looking to get out of their tough situations, both politically and economically. There is political devastation and economic devastation, specifically in Turkey, and there is an economic, clear economic interest to Prince Salman of Saudi Arabia and various other figures in both Saudi Arabia and Turkey to increase these ties that are beneficial for the United States and for other Western vassal states in the Middle East.
Turkish-Saudi relations have remained strained since Khashoggi's murder and dismemberment in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. With the announcement that Turkish courts will no longer seek to hold Khashoggi's murderers accountable, it seems clear that Erdogan has decided to prioritize his political future over the pursuit of justice in the Khashoggi killing. In recent months, Erdogan has spoken of improving ties with Saudi Arabia, hoping that better relations will help Turkey recover from an economic crisis that has left it struggling with 50% inflation. He apparently is hoping to attract financial support and investment from Saudi Arabia as well as the UAE for Turkey's inflation-ravaged economy. Turkish and Emirati leaders recently visited each other's capitals, ending a decade of hostility culminating in Abu Dhabi's announcement that it intended to make $10 billion in new investments in Turkey. In addition to his efforts to improve ties with the Saudis and Emiratis, Erdogan has also looked to improve relations with Israel. The recent visit to Ankara by Israeli President Isaac Herzog signals a reset in Erdogan's stance.
Turkey is trying to view a new balance of power in the Middle East and in relations with all the countries around them. Turkey has always, when it comes to global geopolitics, tried to play both sides. They've been on both sides where they have economic ties in Russia, economic ties and political ties to the United States. And in the Middle East, there has always been a complicated nature of Turkey's relationship to Islamist groups throughout the Middle East, and that entire situation has showed that Turkey doesn't maybe necessarily want to be in the middle ground any longer. And it seems that in this era of rising tensions and changing relations, Erdogan and Turkey is trying to position themselves in a possible place where Western ties and economic benefits shift the balance of power in the region.
Given the emerging degree of cooperation between Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and the US, Erdogan's recent efforts to pursue closer ties with each of these countries may reflect not only his interest in winning foreign investment, but his strategic calculation about the future balance of power in the region.
Over a month ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called a special military operation to, quote, demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. The West, which had been warning Russia against such a move, resorted to providing aid to Kiev and decided not to join the war. It, however, used a different type of warfare, the economic one.
We're coming together to reduce Europe's dependence on Russian energy. Putin has issued Russia's energy resources to coerce and manipulate its neighbors. That's how he's used it. He's used the profits to drive his war machine. And that's why earlier this month I announced the United States would ban all imports of Russian energy.
The United States and its allies imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mainly targeting its energy and banking sectors. The decision is drawing criticism, including from among U.S. lawmakers. Thomas Massie, a Republican representative for Kentucky in the U.S. House, says no treaty can supersede the U.S. Congress in determining when America should go to war. He explains that the often cited Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which states that an attack on one member state will be met with a collective response, isn't binding. That's because Article 11 of the same treaty stipulates that the provisions of the pact must be carried out according to the constitutions of the respective member states.
The United States is putting its country and its citizens in a psychological and economic war against Russia. It's a war against Russia in every sense but a direct military conflict. And there's a very thin line, and we're very near crossing that line to direct military conflict. So what this guy is saying is a correct warning to the American people. We cannot let ourselves be pushed into war by default and by some kind of automatic mechanism that sidesteps what would be the constitutional and legal and political requirements that if we're going to go to war with a country, we have to have a congressional resolution for it.
Besides, as several officials and experts have been warning, cutting off a major country from the global supply chain will expose the whole world to risks that could snowball into a catastrophe of epic proportions. As the US takes aim at Russia, it leaves itself vulnerable to the possible ricochet. U.S. House Representative Thomas Massie agrees, saying the Western sanctions on Russia haven't been thought through. Massie says American farmers who are being cut off from Russia's fertilizers will be hit hard. But that's not all. Russia and Ukraine account for about a quarter of the world's wheat production combined. A prolonged conflict and sanctions on Russia will take a toll on the world's food supply, potentially exposing hundreds of millions to hunger around the world. The price of the sanctions is also being paid at the pumps, especially in the West, with fuel prices soaring to new highs, pushing up the inflation rate in countries like the UK to figures not seen in decades. Numerous academic studies have been conducted on the effectiveness of economic sanctions. They all indicate that the punitive measures do little other than hurt the ordinary citizens.
Sanctions are going to hurt Russia, and they're going to hurt everybody, you know. And Russia has learned to live with sanctions and got along okay, and maybe even better. They've learned to replace some of the things they depended upon. So whatever damage is going to be done to Russia, there is going to be equal or greater damage done to the other side of the sanctions.
Why insist on entering a game that won't have any real winners? Is inflicting pain on a rival worth taking equally, if not more painful, punches?
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we discussed the importance of thanksgiving God, worshiping God, and remembrance of God. An essential way to worship God is to resist against satanic temptations which take us toward sins. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said to Imam Ali, peace upon him, that it is very difficult to be always in remembrance of God. True remembrance of God means that when the ground is set for committing sin, the individual fears God and does not commit sin. God has mentioned examples of those who kept aloof from sin for the sake of God. When the Egyptian chieftain's wife, Zuleika, solicited Prophet Yusuf, the latter refrained from the grave sinful act and preferred God's satisfaction to disgrace in this world and painful punishment of the hereafter. This was because of Yusuf's incessant remembrance of God. There are many ayahs in the Quran which warn us against satanic temptations. For instance, ayah 6 of Surah Fatir reads, Indeed, Satan is your enemy, so treat him as an enemy. Ayah 27 of Surah A'raf also reads, O children of Adam, do not let Satan tempt you like he expelled your parents from paradise. This heedfulness is remembrance of God. In the blessed month of Ramadan, God's servants refine their hearts through doing righteous deeds purely for God's sake. This way, they attain more blessings from God's banquet in this month. The attachment of the faithful to the Quran in this month and paying attention to religious instructions brings more spirituality to their life. Healthy spirits of individuals prevails in the society and makes the society healthy. The deeds of an individual are, in fact, the food of his spirit, since sicken the spirit and good deeds strengthen it. This will bring calm to human being. God says in Ayah 28 of Surah Ra'd, those who have faith and whose hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance, look, the hearts find rest only in Allah's remembrance. The human heart is related to his outward. For instance, if the eyes see something, the heart will seek it. One should control whatever enters his or her heart. The bodily organs are the gates of the heart. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, whatever enters the hearts comes from two ways, the eyes and the ears. The Imam means that we should be very careful on what we listen to and what we look at. Being in close relation with the Quran is very useful for gaining spirituality, especially in the blessed month of Ramadan. The Islamic Iran every year promotes the Quranic culture through recitation of this book in mosques and holy places with scores of thousands of participants. Recitation of the Quran needs some preparations, which have been recommended by religious leaders. One of them is ritual ablution. This helps the reciter of the Quran and the listener to gain more of its benefits. Ayah 79 of Surah Al-Waqi'ah reads in this regard, no one touches it except the pure ones. However, the great servants of God, the friends of God, say that this purity has degrees, meaning that those who want to recite the Quran should have a mouth pure of sins. This will help the word of God enter the heart of the reciter. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has also recommended the faithful to brush their teeth before reciting the Quran. This means that both outward and inward cleanness matter in Islam. Dear listeners, according to the Prophet of Islam and his infallible successors, mere looking at the words of the Quran is an act of worship. Looking kindly at the face of the parents is also worship. Looking at the holy Kaaba is worship too. Looking at the faces of ulama is also considered as worship. Nevertheless, looking at the words of the Quran is very good, especially during the blessed month of Ramadan, provided that it is accompanied by contemplation. Ayah 204 of Surah A'raf reads in this regard, when the Quran is recited, listen to it and be silent. Maybe you will receive Allah's mercy. This Quranic instruction has been mentioned by Imam Sadiq, peace upon him too. The imam says, whenever the Quran is recited at your presence, it is obligatory for you to keep silent and pay attention to it. No doubt, familiarity with the teachings of the Quran does not end here. Recitation of the ayahs of the Quran and understanding their meaning are the first steps for putting into practice in the individual and social life. Ayatollah Khamenei says in this regard, beautiful recitation of the divine ayahs is the prelude for reflection of the Quran. We do not want to engage ourselves to make ourselves busy with recitation and reading the Quran and Quranic tones as a basic issue. This is the prelude. This is the course. Recitation of the Quran with sweet voice causes the human heart to get soft, to be humble, and to be prepared for understanding the Quranic teachings and Quranic ayahs. We need this. Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
A zoo in Ireland's capital, Dublin, has unveiled its newest habitat called the Himalayan Hills, a brand new home of the red panda and the snow leopard. Visitors are able to see the red panda's habitat by traveling along the new trail around a rocky edge to an open viewing area. The red pandas are typically climbing, exploring, or munching on bamboo at the top of broad-leafed evergreen trees. The expanded habitat was designed with a red panda's tree-dwelling lifestyle in mind. Also, visitors can gaze up at the 15-meter rocky slope through an impressive panoramic viewing area to spot the snow leopards. These elusive felines are typically nocturnal, so catching a glimpse of one is a rare treat. The project took a few years to complete. It was halted in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic and massive budget shortages, but was restarted after government funding in 2021. The zoo is part of a protection project for red pandas and snow leopards. These animals are listed as vulnerable due to threats from poaching and severe habitat loss. With neon lights on the floor and walls, pulsing electronic beats, and a glowing red shuttlecock bouncing back and forth, Malaysian badminton court evokes a sci-fi movie set. Shuttle in the Dark is a badminton hall in the iconic Petronas Twin Towers in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It was set up in late 2021 by a sport management company to encourage people to take up the racket sport after 2 years of social restrictions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Director of INIC Sport Management says the initial goal was to draw sports fans and players back into action.
Our initial goal was how can we encourage and gain back the interest of people to come back and play. And not only those enthusiasts, but then as well the new people who was not able to or never play badminton before. So that's why we come out with this experience called Shuttle in the Dark.
Playing on a futuristic court presents an unusual challenge for athletes as they have to adjust their eyes to the darkness to fly. Badminton is one of the most popular sports in Malaysia and Asia, with a thriving community in the southeast Asian community. It has produced some of the world's top-ranked players. Ancient Pompeii has a new guardian, Spot, a four-legged robot dog that will inspect the ancient Italian city's streets and tunnels to identify structural issues. The robot, designed by the U.S. firm Boston Dynamics, will patrol Pompeii at nighttime. The robot inspects the smallest of spaces and gathers data for planning interventions to fix safety and structural issues. Equipped with a 360-degree camera, Spot will also protect the city's streets from illegal relic hunters who cause structural damage to the ruins by digging tunnels. Pompeii will also have its own eye in the sky. A Leica BLK-2 flying laser scanner capable of autonomously conducting 3D scans of the ruins, helping Spot carry out its tasks. Safeguarding ancient sites from treasure hunters has always been a problem for every country, especially the ancient ones.
A super rare birth has added a cute member to critically endangered Sumatran rhinos of Indonesia. The newborn calf is the sixth born since intensive efforts to breed the species began in the 1980s. The female calf, which doesn't have a name yet, was given birth to by a rhino named Rosa in a sanctuary. Rosa has suffered 8 miscarriages since 2005 when she was brought in from the wild for a breeding program. Fewer than 80 Sumatran rhinos remain in the world, mainly on the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. Excessive poaching along with other threats has brought the species to the brink of extinction. The cherry blossom or sakura season in the Japanese capital is a magical experience as trees burst into bloom, dousing the streets with stunning shades of pink. This year, people are enjoying the occasion to the fullest as COVID restrictions are no more there. Thousands gathered in central Tokyo wearing masks, taking pictures and posing for selfies among the trees. Cherry flowers reach full bloom on Sunday, 4 days earlier than usual, according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. The age-old tradition of viewing cherry blossoms typically takes place across the country. The flowers are a national obsession. People flock to parks to hold parties and picnics. However, due to the pandemic, authorities have asked people to refrain from eating and drinking outdoors.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Millions of people across the world celebrate Earth Hour, a symbolic Lights Out event that aims to call attention to environmental issues and the necessity of protecting the planet. The annual event encourages people to turn off their non-essential lighting for an hour and take a break from using electronic devices during that period. Earth Hour takes place every year on the last Saturday of March. The theme of this year's event is Shape Our Future and has been celebrated in more than 180 countries, including Greece, France, Thailand, and Iran. The initiative was first introduced in 2007 by the World Wildlife Fund as a grassroots movement for highlighting the collective responsibility of the people towards their environment. An ancient place in Guatemala with special significance for the Mayan culture could be the next entry on the World Heritage List. The historic village known today as the Takalik Abach Archaeological Park was occupied for 1700 years before it was abandoned and discovered in 1888. It's said to have been home to a pre-Hispanic people. Archaeologists found their way to this mysterious piece of land where they found a series of exotic artifacts and sculptures back in 2008. Guatemala's Minister of Cultural Heritage says this site has a sacred place in the nation's culture.
Tikalikabaj is a sacred place with important links to Guatemala's culture. It's a place that harbors flora and fauna biodiversity and even Mayan spirituality and war is wild. This makes this place highly important within the Mayan culture in Guatemala.
Archaeologists believe the monuments go back to the deep-rooted civilizations of Olmec and Maya in a Central American culture around 400 BC. The government has presented the site to UNESCO, hoping it will be declared a World Heritage Site. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mark Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital Sofia on Wednesday. His first destination, is the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he'll fly south to Africa and then around the globe to cross the finish line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
Egypt's rich history seems to be a gift that keeps on giving. The country has unveiled some exquisite, newly discovered tombs. The pharaonic tombs were found at the Saqqara archaeological site south of Cairo. The site is a big necropolis of Memphis, an ancient capital of Egypt. The graves belonged to a senior royal official, or rather senior royal officials. Some of the graves are engraved with interesting titles such as Steward of the Royal House and Supervisor of the Garden. The tombs are around 4,000 years old, dating back to the Old Kingdom of Egypt.
Iranian families celebrated the ancient tradition of Sizde Bedar, or Nature's Day, by spending some quality time outdoors with family. Yusuf Jalali has a story.
It's Nature's Day in Iran, and parks and countrysides are flooded with families who never miss the chance to spend the final day of Nowruz holidays out with their loved ones. The ancient occasion is called Sizde Bedar. Over the past 2 years, the festival was called off amid the coronavirus pandemic, and it's the first time in 2 years that Sizde Bedar is marked with such a huge crowd.
Because of the coronavirus, people could not go out on Sizde Bedar for 2 years in a row. And this year, the majority are vaccinated and green spaces are jam-packed with picnic goers.
We Iranians have grown up with Sizde Bedar and we never miss it. Thank God we can safely enjoy this amazing tradition this year with all our family members and relatives.
Sizde Bedar means getting rid of number 13. In Persian mythology, 13 is the bad luck number. Now Sizde Bedar is believed to chase away the bad luck and bring good vibes.
Today, we cooked special foods like ash and chicken kebab to eat them for lunch with our family members. We traditionally believe that this day brings bad luck and we must spend it outdoors with joy to get rid of it.
The event is also called the Festival of Nature, and it is an occasion to raise awareness of the need to preserve the environment.
Throughout the history, Iranians have had close relationship with nature, and that's why we have dedicated a special day in our calendar to nature. Before we leave our place here, we clean the environment.
Sizde Bedar is the final day of the two-week celebrations of the Persian New Year, known as Nowruz, which marks the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. The tradition has been celebrated for some 3,000 years in Iran, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan, among other communities. Everyone must have missed outdoor gatherings after more than 2 years of COVID restrictions. Now that worries over the pandemic have eased to some extent, Sizde Bedar once again reunited Iranians with Mother Nature, with all the good vibes and hope for a world free of the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
IRIB English Radio.